A 7 foot, 275-pound man charging across a basketball court to protest a call would seem like an intimidating sight, but not for NBA referee Bob Delaney. Forget about it. That ain't nothing compared to what he endured in his previous life. If you follow basketball, you know Bob Delaney as one of the toughest and most respected referees in the NBA. 30 years ago, he was a New Jersey State Trooper. His assignment? To head up a sting operation known as Project Alpha and figure out how the mafia was taking over legitimate businesses along the Jersey waterfront. Bob Delaney tells his story in a new book called Covert, My Years Infiltrating the Mob.
You hear you're going to go work undercover. You have all these visions and the adrenaline is running through you. And you start to realize that you have to become that new person. The name of the book is Covert. I became Bobby Covert.
Your Robert name Allen was Bobby Covert.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
And no one at the time was thinking, you know, it's like calling yourself Bobby Undercover.
Right. And not until, post-Watergate did that become the common terminology in law enforcement. Prior to that, it was always narcs or street agents or something along that line. We didn't do it to be cute or to be funny. We took on the identity of a child that died at birth. Robert Allen Covert was born dead, and that was in 1948. What we wanted to do was find the same first name, same ethnic-sounding last name, and same age grouping. So I have been Robert or Bob my whole life. You lie about so much when you're undercover that you want to keep some things consistent. And I had to learn how to become part of that subculture that I was attempting to infiltrate.
I don't know. I guess I want to hear how you had to keep undercover in that situation.
Yeah, your morality changes. So I'll just give you an example. You go into a Holiday Inn lounge. And as we got in there, we sat down, and George pointed out a guy that was up at the bar, and he said, he's a cop. And I said, how do you know he's a cop? And he said, well, just look at how he stands. He's standing with his back to the wall because he doesn't want anybody behind him. He's drinking out of a bottle, not drinking out of a glass, because he doesn't want to drink out of a glass like the rest of us. And he's paying cash for his drinks. He's not running a tab. That's not normal in a bar. So what I learned very quickly is that they study us, meaning law enforcement, as much as law enforcement studied them.
I mean, you must have been nervous while you were working with these people.
Tremendous amounts of fear. More often than not, I was wearing a wire, and I was good at doing undercover work. I could go to a meeting, go through and have the meetings with the wise guys, but I'd get 2 miles down the road from that meeting, and I'd have to pull over and throw my guts up. I didn't tell anybody that. You know, law enforcement officers like to think of themselves as leaping tall buildings in a single bound. Well, when you go into doing undercover work, you start to feel fears that you had never experienced before, and you don't want to tell anybody about it. And I didn't for years. For years, I repressed a lot of it and carried it with me because I didn't want to sound like I was afraid.
You said something about how your morality changes. How did your morality change?
You know, I grew up in a certain socioeconomic middle-class family. And you know the difference between right and wrong. And then you become part of the street. And I refer to the street as the toilet. And if you stay in the toilet long enough, you're going to start to stink. I remember defending a guy named Ronnie Sardella and saying to my sergeant, Jack, he's not a bad guy. All he's doing is stolen loads. Meaning, if he wasn't breaking people's legs and putting bullets in people's heads, he wasn't a bad guy. Yet, in 1973, if I would have arrested someone for stolen property, that would have been a tremendous arrest in my mind, and yet here I was defending them.
And then suddenly the plug is pulled on Project Alpha.
Yeah, September 28, 1977, it was decided that, it had gone long enough. And you couldn't wait for this day. And I thought it was going to be the greatest day of my life. We're going to arrest organized crime figures, and I'm going to be back into the fold of the state police and back into the law enforcement community. On that day, they would send out two troopers, a state police detective and an FBI agent, and they would pick up the defendants and bring them in for processing. And a sergeant by the name of Barry Lardier was with me. And for whatever reason, I probably put my hands behind my back to get into a semi-military pose of parade rest to kind of feel a little bit more strength when I would see the people that I had arrested. And a guy by the name of Ronnie Sardella looked over at me and he said, Bobby, what'd they pinch you for? And before I could answer, Barry Lardier said, pinch, he's not pinched, he's with us, he's a trooper. And I dropped my hands. The look that went between he and I was not a look of anger. It was a look of disappointment, of hurt. And he said to me, Bobby, how can you do it to me? I'm your friend. We have been socialized not to tell on our friends. It's an unwritten rule from the playground that you don't tell on someone. And now as an undercover operative, what you're asked to do is become friends with someone and then tell on them. It causes for tremendous pangs of guilt.
Do you miss anything about that world?
No, not now. I'm glad that I've moved on and that I have my life back.
How did you go from being a New Jersey state trooper mob infiltrator to being a well-known, well-respected professional basketball referee?
Basketball was such a big part of my life as a kid. That game is my passion. When I surfaced from doing undercover work, basketball became so important to me because I felt comfortable on the basketball floor. It was something that was organized. It had rules. It had a direction that I was going in. All of those things I had not had in my life for so long. So that was so important to me. And what happened was that I was working a high school ball game, and a guy by the name of Larry Hennessy was at the game. He was the commissioner of the Jersey Shore Summer Pro League, asked me to referee there. I did. Daryl Garrettson, who was the director of officials for the NBA at the time, offered me a position with the Continental Basketball Association, which is the old minor leagues of the NBA. And I worked there and continued my job as a state trooper, but for 3 years worked in the Continental Basketball Association. In 1987, they offered me a full-time position with the NBA, and I took it.
And how does the pressure of your work now compare to the work you did as a trooper?
The pressure before was a lot more intense.
I don't know. I might throw up if Shaquille O'Neal screamed in my face.
Yeah, I understand when people say that. But also, that's my job. We all do things in life that we're good at. And one of the things that I'm good at is refereeing basketball. So it's a comfortableness that goes with being out on that court.
Bob Delaney is a referee in the NBA, and he's the author of the new book, Covert, My Years Infiltrating the Mob. He joined me from the AudioWorks studios in New Orleans. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt about how Bob Delaney began his dangerous assignment, infiltrating the mob, at npr.org/books.
Now from the science of souffle to the making of wine. In 2004, Eric Arnold packed his bags and boarded a plane bound for Marlborough, New Zealand. He spent a year there as an unpaid worker at the Alan Scott Winery. He wrote about the experience in his book called First Big Crush. And Arnold says he didn't know much about wine before this adventure.
Really, I think the limit of it was just about how much I could drink before I'd get sick, I think. I really didn't know anything else about wine. It really started when I went on vacation to New Zealand in 2001, and a British guy who I was traveling around the South Island with said, hey, when we get to Marlborough, we should go visit some wineries. And from the, you know, the very first sip, I was just enamored with this stuff.
Why were the people at the Alan Scott Winery willing to take you on?
Naivety, maybe? I don't know. No, I think, you know, the thing is, Alan Scott is he's a brilliant guy. And, I mean, he's always had a great sense of sort of where wine fits into society, and that it's a tourism business, that it's an agriculture business, and that, it, quite frankly, that it's the alcohol business and it's marketing. So when I emailed him out of the blue, you know, him not knowing me, me not knowing him, he just said, hey, well, you know, why not give it a try? And next thing I knew, I'm still there after a year. So.
2004, that's the vintage, the year that you were there. And this was a pretty remarkable harvest, was it not?
It was, it was. It was really one of the biggest they'd ever seen, volume-wise. It's one of the things that people don't realize about growing grapes and making wine is that the amount of grapes that are on each vine is carefully controlled. Actually, the lower the crop, not always, but the lower the crop, a lot of times the better the wine, ultimate wine quality. So if you grow too many grapes per vine, you get basically, I don't know, dishwasher detergent or something. So in this particular year, just the weather conditions were such that the crop volume was the biggest it had ever been for the region. So it was going to take a lot of work to bring it all in.
What was the hardest job you had to do?
One of the worst is pruning the vines at the end of the season. Basically, you know, once the grapes are all picked and all the leaves have fallen off the vines, you have to trim all of the excess branches off of each vine and basically reposition the vine to grow the best possible crop that you can the following year. And this is one of the most physically demanding and really awful tasks. And the best people at it make a ton of money doing it because they get paid by the vine. But also it requires extreme precision and skill. And, you know, it, me just going out there and doing it, I kept getting whacked in the face with branches. And it's very humbling.
What was the biggest mistake you made?
It was a joint effort between myself and the winemaker. We dropped the metal fitting on a big hose into a pump. And I did not realize the power that this pump had. And it just started pulling this this stainless steel fitting through, and this giant, you know, $10,000 piece of equipment started to lurch around as if it was having an epileptic seizure, and I caused a significant amount of damage to it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't put you on a plane then.
I'm surprised they didn't put me through the pump. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, though, all of my screw-ups were really, apparently, from what I was told, nothing compared to what most people, the damage that most people caused in their first vintage.
Explain how you got grape skins in your underwear.
Well, it's really fun. I put them there.
Come on.
Basically, the difference between red wine and white wine is that with white wine, you basically just ferment the clear juice. With red wine, you put everything, the skins, the seeds, the crushed berries, all go into the tank. And that's what makes red wine red, is because the skins of the grapes are red. So when the wine is done fermenting, you have to separate the skins and the actual wine. So basically, you run all of the wine out of the tank, and it goes through a sieve and everything, and you can put, just pump it into another tank. But then you're left in this tank full of skins, and you have to get them out. So, you know, it's over your waist level when you jump into the tank. So, you know, if you're not wearing like a some sort of work suit, you know, all the skins go right into your boots, into your pants, and into your underwear.
Boy, this is really dirty work, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was something I was just not expecting. And, you know, people associate wine with sophistication and glamour, and producing it just isn't sophisticated or glamorous. You know, if you go to work at a winery, you know, you really got another thing coming to you.
Eric Arnold is the author of First Big Crush, The Down and Dirty of Making Great Wine Down Under. It's published by Scribner. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thanks very much for having me here.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
To have a father die of a heart attack right in front of you when he was 50 and you're 16 puts a kind of time bomb off in your mind. It's hard to see yourself living much longer than your father did. And as that year approaches, you hear ticking. Steve McKee, who works at the Wall Street Journal and lives in Brooklyn, neared that age and could practically hear ticking, or, in his case, soft plaque collecting. He was a devoted runner, but couldn't outrun his genetic history. He was diagnosed with his own heart disease. The story of a son discovering his father and a new life for himself is told in Steve McKee's new memoir, My Father's Heart. He joins us from our studios in New York. Mr. McKee, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Your father was 43 when he had his first heart attack. But how did that change him?
After that first heart attack, I think he sort of gave up. His father had had a heart attack in 1941 mm-hmm. at age 53, and I think my father just figured, well, there's the deal.
Is it almost hard for us living in a time when, for example, famous football coaches have heart attacks and they're back on the sidelines 5 days later, to appreciate what a heart attack meant in 1963, when medical science was good enough to keep you from dying, but really couldn't do much to build you back up?
You know, thinking back on it, you know, he had his heart attack on February 2nd, and he was in the hospital for probably a good 4 weeks, pretty much literally flat on his back with orders not to raise his arms above his head. And then it was another probably 2 months at home, and it was all about just sort of resting. I mean, that I realize now that's all he really knew to do was sort of wait and see what would happen next. Mm-hmm. It actually makes me wonder how bad his heart attack could have been if it didn't kill him.
Can I get you to talk about the night he died?
Yes. It was the two of us at home alone, and we were watching Marcus Welby. And actually,
Robert Young is the kindly suburban doctor.
Yes, who had just in the show had just had a heart attack, and we're watching. And all of a sudden, I actually hear something before I see anything, and it is just air being pulled through clenched teeth, and I turn to look, and my father is his back is arched, very very straight, and he is like being pressed. I feel as though something was pressing him into the sofa, and then he started snapping back and forth a couple times. I don't really know how many times, but he'd be sort of thrown forward and then snapped back. I come over to him, and when his head would snap back, I could look into his eyes. He had beautiful green eyes. They were completely lifeless, sort of staring past me. I run upstairs to the phone. My mom's not home. She's down playing bridge at a friend's house about a half a mile away. And the phone's dead. They were building new homes in the development where I lived, and they were constantly taking out the phone lines. I go downstairs. I see Dad. At this point, he has stopped snapping back and forth, and he's just kind of limp. I then run outside to the neighbor up the hill, nobody home, run down past our house to the neighbor down below us. There's nobody home there. I go running back into the house, and I can remember specifically standing in the TV room telling myself not to panic. Don't panic. Don't panic. What am I going to do? So I go upstairs and get a blanket, bring it down, wrap it around him. At this point, there is white, foamy stuff coming out of his mouth. And I then run back out of the house, and I'm going to run up to the next house up the hill beyond where the first neighbor was, at which point a cop car comes cruising down the street. So I literally run this car down, and he ends up stopping in front of the house. And I
you start thumping on the police car.
Right. Yes. I'm running down and I'm shouting at him. He's not stopping. So I start pounding on the trunk. At which point he stops very abruptly, and gets out of the car. And I explain what has happened. And then he walks into the house. That's I really really remember that real well. How he just very calmly walked into the house. And at that point, my father is almost completely off the sofa. He has wet himself, and it's kind of like hanging between staying upright and falling over. The cop comes over and looks for a pulse under his neck and sort of flops my dad's head back. I, at that point, then look for a pulse. I sit down next to him. You know, I like to think I found his final pulse. It's how I remember it. And it just was like this machine gun of beats and then nothing. And I told the cop that he was dead. And at that point, I ran out of the house and then ran down to get my mother playing bridge.
One of your high school coaches gave you some very wise advice.
Yeah, Coach Jim Forge, and he was the basketball coach at York Catholic High School through the 60s. My dad died on Tuesday, September 30th, and I was out of school for a full week and got back on Tuesday the 7th. And I'm sitting in seventh period study hall, and as it turns out, I'm the only person in the study hall. It was one of these quirks of scheduling, mm-hmm. And the study hall is right next to Coach Forgeon's office. Now, you got to know a little bit about Coach. He's tall, thin. We're talking 1969, crew cut, thin tie, horn-rimmed glasses. You know, he's the classic nerdy coach. And again, I mean that in a good way.
Crew cut when much of the rest of the world
right.
had hair curling over
yes,
their ears.
Yeah. And he ruled the school. In addition to being the head basketball coach, he was also the school disciplinarian. So he comes and suddenly is standing there framed in a doorway. And he said, "Steve, get in my office." So at this point, I figure I am doomed. You know, I have no idea why, but I have to be. So I get into his office, and then we just sit there. He doesn't say a word. He's just scribbling on paper, whatever. And then finally he says to me, "How you doing?" I say, "I'm okay, Coach." And he just swats those words out of the air. And he says, "No, you're not. Your father just died. Your father just died, and you'll never get over it." I mean, it was stunning. It was absolutely stunning. But it took all the tension out of the week, the previous week. And then he said, in almost a kindly sort of way, with his kind of a voice, he said, "But you will get used to it." And I've always, always remembered that. And I just will always be tremendously grateful.
Let me take your life forward, because you became you were a devoted athlete and runner, and one day you're sitting in a very fancy medical office and get a diagnosis that shakes you up.
Yes, that was tax day, 2005. I did one of those executive physicals, you know, the 8-hour thing with the treadmill test and you know, the nutritional analysis and the consult with the doctor and the full body scan and then the 64 CT slice scan of the chest and the heart and all that. And I didn't want to do this. It was Noreen's idea. You know, from my standpoint, you know, what was it going to tell me? I was in good shape. I was in great shape. And that's what it told me. I did real well on the stress test. I was, you know, the aerobic capacity of a man, 8 years younger, recovery 20 years younger. So when I went in to see the doctor at the end of the day, I was fully prepared for my Lifetime Achievement Award. I mean, I really was. And we're sitting there, and Dr. David Fine, great, great person, the way he relates to you. He's got a really bold, kind of quirky sense of humor. And he points me to the computer screen that has all these, you know, my heart sliced into 64 pieces and starts clicking through them. And then suddenly there it is. There's a white line in this, all this gray, and he didn't have to say a word. I knew exactly what it was. It was devastating, absolutely devastating, because I never, ever thought this was going to happen because I had spent all those years keeping myself in good to very good shape. And here I was, I had just been certified as being in very good shape, and I still have heart disease. And it was absolutely devastating.
Did it make you feel that it had all been for naught?
For a while, yes. And the reason was, for a while, I equated the fact that if I had heart disease, then I therefore had to be like my father had been, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, in those 6 years. It took a while for me to realize that, no, even if I have heart disease, I am not like that part of my father I didn't want to be. You know, my dad, I felt, gave up. I had always fought against it. You know, that is his legacy to me. I have always fought against it. And here I am. You know, Dr. Fine even said, you know, there's no way to know for sure. But, you know, perhaps if I had not done what I had done all these years with my family history, I wouldn't even have been sitting in his office.
What are among the hardest things of not having your father along these days?
It's all very much attached to the important moments in a life. It doesn't even mean my life. It just in, you know, all the things in a life that are important. He has not been there since I was 16. You know, you could now tell me all the ones: my high school graduation, college graduation, my wedding. You know, probably the biggest one, though, clearly would have to be when we adopted, and my father wasn't there to sort of hand him off. Yeah, that would be number one, with the wedding right behind it. You know, and I also realize, and I say this in the book, that I'm telling a very ordinary story here, and if there's power in it, that's what it is. It's the fact that it's an ordinary story. You know, I'm not the only person whose father died of a heart attack. I'm not the only person whose father died when they were 16. But it's ordinary, but there's the power, I hope.
Mr. McKee, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Steve McKee's new book is My Father's Heart, and to read an excerpt, you can come to our website, npr.org/books. A young man fresh out of college might look forward to a summer traveling abroad or working at some prestigious internship. But after graduating 2 years ago, Adam Shepherd decided to join the ranks of the working poor. He left his home state of North Carolina with little more than $25 in his pocket and the clothes on his back, gave himself a year to find an apartment, buy a car, and build up a couple of $1,000s in savings. Adam Shepherd did establish some rules for his experiment. He couldn't use his personal connections, his college education, or credit card to survive, and he couldn't beg for money. Within a year, he'd found an apartment, a car, and a steady job and had more than $5,000 saved. Adam Shepherd has written about his experiences in Scratch Beginnings, Me, $25, and The Search for the American Dream. He joins us from member station WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Shepherd.
Thank you very much for having me.
And of all the things to do, why did you decide to do this?
I thought this would be a great time to institute this plan, which was my response to a book by Barbara Ehrenreich called Nickel and Dimed. She did a project of her own where she essentially wrote on the death of the American dream. And I read her book in college, and I wasn't particularly impressed. And so I decided to do this little project of my own to make the discovery of the American dream for myself.
How did you live? I mean, where did you live?
I arrived in Charleston for the first two weeks.
Charleston, South Carolina.
South Carolina, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. For the first 2 weeks, I did construction cleanup, garbage cleanup. And then after 2 weeks, I got a permanent job as a mover. For the first 70 days, I was living in the homeless shelter. And from there, I moved my way up. 2 months, I rented a room from a guy downtown. And from there, I signed a lease for an apartment for 1 year. It was just all about anything that I could save. Transportation, I waited until I had enough money to buy a car, so I was taking the bus. Food, I could cook two meals for $5, or I could go out and eat for $7 or $10. The thing is, it wasn't a lot, and you save $5, $10 a day, but in the grand scheme of things, that's so much money.
You know, a lot of people work two jobs, and they wind up eating out because that's all they can do on a schedule like that.
You don't have to eat out. You can pack a microwavable something. I mean, I fortunately only had to work one job. I was a busy guy as well, you know, and I still found time to pack my lunch and take the bus.
didn't you have a lot of advantages that let's say an ex-felon looking for a job who might have to make child support payments doesn't?
I had a very difficult time actually working my way in. I mean, this was a world of convicted felons, and here comes Adam with his floppy hair and his shorts trying to work his way in to a whole new world, a whole new culture. So did it play to my advantage from the respect that I knew how to budget my money? Perhaps, but how much of an education do you need to make the decision that, listen, if I'm buying beer and cigarettes and lottery tickets, then my money is going out the door.
Did you have any friends?
One guy that I met, Phil Coleman, he gave me the secret to getting a job.
What is the key to getting a job?
You know, I was sitting there and I was not really happy that I had passed out 50 applications and nobody was getting back to me. And he just went nuts and he said, listen, Adam, you are a homeless dude. Nobody looks at your application, you know, because I had my homeless shelter as my address. Mm-hmm. Nobody looks at that and says, hey, yeah, I want to hire Adam Shepard, the homeless guy. You have to go to these managers and say, I'm Adam Shepard, and I am the greatest mover on the planet. And so that's how I got my first job as a mover.
What's your life like now?
I'm working my way up just like the next guy, and now I'm back in Raleigh, North Carolina, mm-hmm. and I'm, you know, working as a skycap at the airport, and I'm working to get this message out to say, hey, guys, listen. Here is your life, and if you're poor or rich, if you make $8 or $50 an hour, if you live in a nice house or a little apartment or in a homeless shelter, you have your life ahead of you.
Adam Shepard, the author of Scratch Beginnings, Me, $25, and The Search for the American Dream.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Around this time of year, for more than 20 years now, women all around the country have checked their mailboxes and been happy to find a postcard bearing a red heart in the corner and a poem. A Valentine from Ted Kooser, who was this country's poet laureate from 2004 to 2006. He has collected those poems now in a book called Valentines, and it starts with this one titled Pocket Poem.
If this comes creased and creased again and soiled, as if I'd opened it 1,000 times to see if what I'd written here was right, it's all because I looked too long for you to put it in your pocket. Midnight says the little gifts of loneliness come wrapped by nervous fingers. What I wanted this to say was that I want to be so close that when you find it, it is warm from me.
Ted Kooser, do you remember the guy who wrote that poem back in 1986?
Well, sort of. I do. You know, in a way, I stole the idea for this poem. One of my good friends was trying to seduce a woman and would leave little scraps of paper in the pockets of her sweater whenever she would hang it up. And I thought it was such a good idea that I'd make a poem to use in that way.
He left them anonymously. She didn't know who they were from.
Well, I think she knew who they were from, sure. But, you know, it worked.
It did work.
Yeah.
That poem, Pocket Poem, is a really, you know, romantic gesture poem. But there are a lot of others that are more oblique. And there's one I'd love you to read. This is one of my favorites.
Okay.
It's called A New Potato.
A New Potato. That's back in here a ways. Oh, yes. A New Potato. This is just one of the leathery eggs, the scuffed-up, dirty turtle of the moon buried early in spring, her eyes like stars fixed on the future, and, inside its red skin, whiteness, like all of the moons to come, and marvelous, buttered with light.
That's some potato.
Well, you know, on all these Valentine poems, Melissa, I've tried to get a little red in them or something or other, you know, that would relate back to Valentine's, if not love, color or something. And I thought these new potatoes with that red skin, you know, some of them are really quite heart-shaped in a way, and that's really why I got to it, I think.
Ted, how did all this start, these Valentine poems that you've been sending out for so long now?
Well, I have a very good friend, Dotsa Burdick, and she has been sending out Valentines that she's made for many, many years. And One year, I guess in 86, I decided, well, maybe I could do something like this and send out a poem. And I sent out maybe in the first year, maybe 50 of them, mostly to the wives of my friends and so on. And then the list built up, oh, gradually over the years, you know, women would say that they thought it'd be fun to get a Valentine and so on. And then when I was appointed poet laureate and started doing a whole lot more public appearances, I would read one of the Valentine poems at many of those readings, and then I would say, if there are any women in this audience who would like to be on my annual Valentine mailing list, you know, leave your name and address afterwards. And so by the time I stopped last year, I had 2,700 names on my list, and I spent almost $1,000 in postage and printing, and I thought, well, you know, you've probably taken this almost too far. So I decided I would rein it in. You know, I may go back to writing Valentine poems again someday, but not to that huge list.
I wonder if you're going to be writing a poem sometime this next year and just wish for that mailing list back and just think maybe you need to send out a couple thousand of them all over again.
Well, yeah, that could certainly happen. And I've got the mailing list, so sure. It's always been a lot of fun sitting there in front of the television on one of those TV trays with a huge stack of these cards sticking those little red hearts on it as I watched Law and Order reruns and so on.
Very romantic.
Yes, very romantic indeed, yeah. Sometimes when I had the time and the scheduling worked out right, I would send them all up to the postmaster in Valentine, Nebraska, and have him stamp them from Valentine. But I couldn't do that every year because I was sometimes right down to the wire.
There's a poem that's toward the end of the collection, so it must be one that you wrote fairly recently. And it's a poem of great promise and potential, I think, called A Map of the World.
Oh, yeah. I like this poem. I had bought a calendar that was a yearly calendar, and the pictures on it were all ancient maps of the world. And there was one map that actually was heart-shaped, a map of the world. One of the ancient maps of the world is heart-shaped, carefully drawn, and once washed with bright colors, though the colors have faded, as you might expect feelings to fade from a fragile old heart, the brown map of a life. But feeling is indelible and longing infinite, a starburst compass pointing in all the directions two lovers might go, a fresh breeze swelling their sails, the future uncharted, still far from the edge where the sea pours into the stars.
I love that image.
Thank you.
We should say that you do have a wife, Kathleen, who's been very tolerant of this passion of yours over the years.
Oh, yeah, and I think she's enjoyed it. You know, from time to time, the husbands of some of the women on my list would send her Valentines. But she's very patient with me. She understands that I'm harmless, I think.
She won't be getting those Valentines, I guess, anymore from those husbands, then.
Well, I have special Valentines for her, so...
You do include one last Valentine in this book. This is one you wrote for your wife, Kathleen, called The Hognosed Snake.
Yes, this was... I actually wrote this for Kathy as a wedding anniversary prank, I guess, more than anything else. But I've had a lot of fun with this poem because, you know, from time to time when I'm out doing readings, people who have traditional tastes in poetry will say, well, can't you write a poem that rhymes and is in meter and so on? So... this is the one that I always recite to them on those occasions. As you know, it's a tender, loving little poem. The Hognosed Snake. The hognosed snake, when playing dead, lets its tongue loll out of its ugly head. It lies on its back as stiff as a stick. If you flip it over, it'll flip back quick. If I seem dead when you awake, just flip me once, like the hognosed snake.
Words to live by, I think, Ted.
Yes, right, yeah.
You know, when we met several years ago for the first time, we came out to your house there in Garland, Nebraska, and you talked about Valentine's Day as the poet's holiday.
That's right, and I still think that. It's not tied up with anything other than expressions of sentiment, and it seems like a great holiday for the poet.
Well, Ted, happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you, and it's a great pleasure talking to you again.
Poet Ted Kooser. His book is titled Valentines. You can hear and read more of his Valentine poems at npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Just in time for Valentine's Day, here's a non-romantic romantic pitch, a short story collection from the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the novel Middlesex.
If any guy were to buy this for his girlfriend, his stock would rise quite quickly. And I think if any women buy the book, they actually might realize they just don't need a guy. So I think it'll help on both sides.
Writer Jeffrey Eugenides edited this collection, but they're not your mother's love stories. Sure, he includes some of the great romantics, Chekhov and Nabokov, but this anthology is less about love and more about the disappointment and the heartburn that come with that four-letter word. We began with an explanation of the book's title, My Mistress's Sparrow is Dead.
Yes, a rather gloomy-sounding title for a book of love stories.
Yes.
It derives from the Roman poet Catullus. He had a girlfriend named Lesbia who had a pet sparrow.
You know, it would seem a shame to talk about this poem without reading from a portion of it. Do you happen to have the book right there?
I do. This is the first poem. Sparrow, my girl's darling, whom she plays with, whom she cuddles, whom she likes to tempt with fingertip and teases to nip harder, when my own bright-eyed desire fancies some endearing fun, and a small solace for her pain, I suppose, so heavy passion then rests. Would I could play with you as she does, and lighten the spirit's gloomy cares. That poem is the first poem where we see the sparrow, and obviously the sparrow is in the way. Catullus wishes to be with his girlfriend, but she's more interested in the sparrow. Now, that's poem two. Poem three, the sparrow has died. It seems like things are going to get better for Catullus. He's now going to have Lesbia as much as he wants, but it turns out that she's too grief-stricken by the death of her sparrow, and so can't really pay attention to him. So I saw these two poems, and after reading all the love stories in this collection, I realized that they are the two poles around which all these love stories revolve. You have in the first poem voyeuristic longing, and then the second poem a kind of disenchanted entanglement.
You know, when you think about this collection of stories, you seem to note that the tension in these stories depends on people coming from very different places, that you need disappointment or feuding families or people who were sort of born to unequal stations.
Right, that's what I discovered. I didn't really start with any preconceptions about love stories. I just asked everyone I knew, writers and friends, what's your favorite love story? And I read lots and lots of love stories. And after about a year of this, I started to realize that not only the love stories that I liked, but actually the love stories that everyone liked had a certain bittersweet quality to them. The stories in this collection are by no means all tragic, but in order to even get to a measure of happiness, the characters usually have to go through a lot of difficulty.
Yeah, it's almost, I don't want to rip off John Bon Jovi, but if you look at this collection in total, it seems to give love a bad name.
Well, I think love stories do give love a bad name, but the thing is, with a love story, you actually can participate from a distance. So I recommend it, actually, instead of going out on Valentine's Day. It's probably a much safer course to stay home and read Joyce's The Dead or Spring and Field by Nabokov. And you don't have to see those terrible little red carnations sprouting at the tables of the restaurants.
I'd like to ask you about one of the stories in particular in the book.
Sure.
A story called We Didn't.
The Stuart Dybeck story, that's a wonderful story to read. I'm sure it was wonderful to write it, but at least I got to read it.
Could you read a little bit of it for us?
Sure. We didn't in the light. We didn't in darkness. We didn't in the fresh-cut summer grass, or in the mounds of autumn leaves, or on the snow where moonlight threw down our shadows. We didn't in your room on the canopy bed you slept in, the bed you'd slept in as a child, or in the back seat of my father's rusted Rambler, which smelled of the smoked chubs and kielbasa he delivered on weekends from my Uncle Vincent's meat market. We didn't in your mother's Buick 8, where a rosary twined the rearview mirror like a beaded black snake with silver cruciform fangs. I don't want to give this story away, but on the beach, Oak Street Beach in Chicago, they come close to doing it, and something happens to prevent them.
Something very awful.
And as often is the case, it's those times where desire is frustrated that linger in the mind the longest.
You know, when we talk about love stories, and the thing that draws us and sucks us in almost to a vortex, it seems like it's not the love itself. It's the I don't know, almost like viewing the world from a position of absolute vulnerability.
It's vulnerability and the kind of heightened awareness, I think, that people feel when they're in love. When I think about a lot of my favorite novels, Portrait of a Lady by Henry James or Lolita by Nabokov, I mean, they are all love stories. Anna Karenina, obviously, is another one. And in the case of Lolita, it can be kind of a perverse love story. But still, the force of the desire drives the prose and drives the plot.
Do you consider yourself to be a romantic?
I consider myself too old to be a romantic anymore. I was terribly romantic as a youth, and I think I retain a portion of that romanticism. I know Saul Bellow, who was married, four times, managed to stay romantic and weep over his new girlfriends even in his 60s, and his friends were always kind of impressed that he'd stayed youthful in that way. It seems to me both admirable and rather laughable to be that way in your 60s or 70s. I'm a father and husband, and I find that as life goes on, the kind of youthful romanticism changes into a deeper kind of familial romanticism that is not really something so often written about in these kinds of stories.
Jeffrey Eugenides, thank you so much for talking to us. Happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, I was going to ask you if you're doing anything special for Valentine's Day, but you're someone special might be listening.
I'll tell you, one of the first things my wife Karen and I decided when we got together was that we would never celebrate Valentine's Day. So it was one of the first things that made me fall in love with her. It was our mutual antipathy for Valentine's Day. So,
wait a minute. An author who puts together a collection of love stories has total antipathy toward Valentine's Day?
Oh, yes. Don't you think it's the cheapening and commodification of something rare that we'd all like to celebrate in private and at our own time?
I personally like flowers and chocolate, so...
Okay, well, you're a special person, I hope, is listening.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Jeffrey Eugenides is the author of The Virgin Suicides and Middlesex. You can read more about that dead sparrow's role in these love stories at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.